It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
It's been really busy times for both you and Toby in the past few years. Was it a surprise when things finally came back around and you found yourself doing another Pride of Lions record?
Well, I was, you know, when I designed this project way back in 2002, I knew this wasn't going to be a one-off deal. You know, when I found Toby, I really knew it was going to have some legs to it. Basically, that was my chance to, you know, I left Survivor in 96, and with it, I forfeited the name Survivor. And I was really eager to create another logo, another brand, similar to Survivor in that sound, but obviously different than that as well. So that first album came out in 2003 and made a major impact in Europe and Japan. Not so much in the States. It was mainly a European thing. And then, you know, they just kept rolling out. Serafino, the president of Frontiers, you say, hey, it's time for another, you know. And we, before you knew it, we had, you know, three albums out and a Live from Belgium DVD, which was, you know, pretty cool. And then, you know, 5 years took over, and I did so many things in the interim. You know, I produced Jimmy Jameson's Crossroads Moment album and contributed songs to Jameson Kimball and Fergie Fredrickson, and on and on. And I was just kind of a little bit burned out, you know, when Serafino asked me, hey, it's time for another Pride of Lions record. And I go, well, maybe not. You know, I wanted to keep going, but I wasn't really ready to write another 11 songs that I considered to be the quality that I'm looking for. And at that point, he said, well, we want to do a solo album with Toby, with someone else producing. Is that okay? I said, yeah, you know, as long as it's different enough from what we do with Pride of Lions. And Serafino assured me that it was different. And it, as it turned out to be a much heavier record than Pride of Lions, which is I'm really glad about. And Toby, he made a lot of fans with this record, showing, you know, people what he could do on his own. And by then, finally, when that album came out and did well, then I got my juices back flowing, and I was on the road, and I wrote a song in the dressing room with a girl named Pamela McNeil called Coin of the Realm. And I turned that into Serafino, and he flipped out, and then it just, you know, the creativity started flowing, and I was writing a song or two or three songs every week till I had about 13 tunes, and that became the album that's out right now called Immortal.
Very cool. You know, I've been listening to a lot of the Pride of Lions stuff recently, and something that just kind of came to me that I just was curious to get your thoughts on, and that is, you know, listening to a song like Between Two Fires from when you were doing the world stage stuff, and the vocal approach that you took to some of that world stage stuff, the way, you know, you would trade off with, you know, the other vocalist. How much of a template did that give you as far as contributing towards the idea when you were, you know, putting together Pride of Lions and figuring out the approach that you were going to take?
Yeah, a great question. Actually, that concept dated way back to when I was putting Survivor together back in 1978. I had always thought of it being a two-singer format with Dave Bickler and myself trading off leads, and maybe he would have a few songs on his own, I'd have a few songs of my own. And on that first album, the one with Kim Basinger on the cover, there's a couple of examples like that, such as Love Has Got Me, and of course Rocket Into the Night, which actually didn't appear on that record, but that was also a duet. But by the second album, I just stopped singing, and mainly because I was being discouraged to sing by Frankie, mainly. He wanted really a one-singer format, and there was some history that would prove him correct that, you know, the more successful bands had one mouthpiece, you know. And it was such a great band that I wasn't going to fight it too hard, but it was always a real, you know, sad thing for me that I wasn't singing more. So obviously, you know, when I left Survivor and I put together World Stage, it was a great opportunity to finally be heard and do duets with, you know, Kelly Kagi and, like you said, Kevin Cronin and Don Barnes and on and on. So when I put together Pride of Lions, that was the concept. It was basically I wanted to do it the way I wanted to do it in 1978, obviously now with Toby Hitchcock.
Jim, one of the things that strikes me about Pride of Lions is that you started off wanting to, you said you wanted to bring forth your vision of the best elements of the great melodic rock era of the 80s and update it for the present day. And that's something that a lot of acts from that era have a really hard time doing when they try to release new music. And it's, you know, they often sound self-conscious about trying to recapture the vibe of that era, but that isn't something that I hear on the Pride Alliance stuff. And I wondered what your approach was to kind of trying to recapture that sound without making it seem like you wish it still were the 80s. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. I think if there's a problem with the majority of the AOR, you know, reunions, it's that they try too hard. It's almost like a caricature of the 80s. Survivor was never a caricature. We always played music that supported the song. We were a songs band. If you listen to, you know, The Search Is Over, they call it a power ballad, but nowhere to be found are there the big Whitesnake power chords. We never really pandered to some of the most obvious cliches of 80s music, and no different now, really. If it supports the song, that's the way I arrange it.
There are sounds, though, that harken back to that era. And I just wonder, where, as a producer, do you draw the line between... it seems to me that it would be kind of tricky to say, okay, well, you know, we have to put enough in there to satisfy the fans of that era without really going overboard with keyboards, right, or chords, guitars, stuff like that. I wondered, how deliberate is your approach? Or do you just go with what feels right?
Well, I mean, there is that thought to it, you know, where you know you got to have the synths going, playing eighth notes here and there. And you know you have to get some of the flashy leads in. But I do it, I try to do it with taste, you know, so it, like I said, it's not a cartoon version of it. I do love the format, though. I must say, people ask me, you write in all directions from R&B to country to jazz. What's your favorite? I have to say it's AOR, it's melodic rock. That's kind of where I hang my hat, and I've had my most success. I love big choruses. I love lots of melody. And I love positive messages. And those are all the things that Survivor stood for, Journey stood for, to most extent Foreigner, all the bands that, you know, I came up with and loved.
You know, you talk about those positive messages. You know, one of those that I see on this new record is your track from the album, you know, Delusional. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really cool song.
Thank you for bringing that up. That's the single on the album, and it's also the video. I don't know if you've seen the video, but it's really making an impact out there on people. You know, it seems like everyone knows somebody with a child that has attention deficits, or, you know, any number of those initials that they give kids and teenagers and adults. Sometimes they're prescribed correctly. Sometimes they're not even needed, some of the pills that they give, like Ritalin and things like that. This song is just a commentary of saying, let the boy dream. Let the girl be a girl. Let the kids be kids. You know, when I was being hyperactive, my dad would tell me to go climb a tree. Now they'll put a pill in his mouth, you know, and the message has really reacted to people. And of course, in the video, you know, we have a young girl who's dreaming of being a singer, and her mom is, you know, oh, you'll never do it, you know, and the skinny teenager who wants to be a football star, and the coaches are shaking their heads. And at the end of the day, oh, and then you have Fergie making a cameo as the doctor dispensing the pills. And it's very, very, very funny. But by the end, you know, the football player is gaining respect, and the girl joins Pride of Lions on stage for the last chorus. And recently, Pride of Lions opened for Styx in New Lenox, Illinois. And we actually had the girl, whose name is Maggie Perez, come up on stage with us and reprise that role, and the people went crazy.
One of the things that Matt and I are really fascinated by, in terms of your career, is just the way that you've been able to maintain a level of personal success even after the market for that style of music kind of bottomed out in the late 80s or early 90s. And you're talking about singles and videos, and it makes me wonder if there was ever a time in the early to mid 90s when you wondered if maybe you were going to reach a point where you wouldn't be releasing singles or filming videos.
You know, I must have some kind of a defense mechanism. I never felt that. You know, one of the best attributes of a person is denial. And I was in serious denial that would ever happen. I had this faith, and I still do, that if you write a great song, it will get heard. People will want to hear it. If it puts you in a good mood or makes you think or makes you feel, there's always going to be a market for that. I don't care about downloads. I don't care about the business. I never looked at the bottom line anyway. You look at the bottom line, that's the wrong target. You look at, you know, doing a great song, doing a great vocal, changing people's lives for the better. I mean, the money, the royalties, that's icing on the cake. That's a result of connecting with people. It isn't the goal.
I'll ask a question now from this side of things, I guess following up on that. You know, when things did go quiet with Survivor, I guess at the end of the 80s, you know, how much of a struggle was it to figure out your next move at that point?
Well, you know, Survivor, you know, struggled on through the 90s because, well, Jimmy Jameson had his own version of Survivor, and which was, you know, in our mind, me and Frankie's mind, very illegal because we owned the name at the time.
Yeah.
So that was a whole struggle. And then in 93, we put together a reunion Survivor with Dave Bickler and toured Germany and Europe and America. And that was all good. But 96 came, and I just, it was really weird, or not weird, but ironic. On the 4th of July, Independence Day, is the day I didn't show up to the show in the South, opening up for 38 Special. I didn't get on the plane. There was a very bad incident the day before, really a confrontation between Frankie and I. So in 96, you know, it was like the feeling of freedom was scary, and yet it was really cool. And I didn't really care what my next move was. All I knew is I was breathing the air of freedom. And that was my main emotion was, now I can do anything I want. And actually, you know, the first thing I did, of course, was put together World Stage. And that was something that could never have happened while I was a member of Survivor, you know. And I started designing, you know, started calling my old friends from the 80s, people I toured with, people that I wrote with, you know, your Don Barnes and Kelly Kagi and Jack Blades, Rick Emmett, Tom Kiefer of Cinderella, on and on, Dennis DeYoung, just having a ball rounding up my buddies and doing these shows. So that was my first stepping stone, and that led the way to Pride of Lions. But every year, including January 19th coming up, it's a World Stage show, and they sell out just about instantly, and it's just been really a blessing.
What has that done for you artistically, the World Stage stuff? It seems like that's driven your songwriting in a lot of positive directions.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, when I see the other guys and what they're doing, I still have a competitive sense, a friendly one. You know, if Jack Blades shows me a song, I'll say, that's really good. And then I'll go to the piano and try to beat it. You know, I mean, it's no different than the old days when we heard Foreigner's new single and said, holy mackerel, we better do better than that because that's really good, you know. So, I mean, it's just a healthy sense of competition.
Well, could we get you to do a song, maybe, you know, maybe one of your favorites from the new record?
You know, I would rather do something from the catalog, only because the new record is so darn layered. I play it with the band, but I don't. Would you mind hearing something from the archives?
Not at all.
Absolutely, man. Not at all.
Cool. Well, I won't do a whole song, but I'm going to do a song that everybody, of course, hears and loves, hopefully, Eye of the Tiger. But the song that gets kind of second, you know, what do you call it? Second place always is Burning Heart from Rocky IV. And yet, you know, I love that song. Maybe it's because it is the underdog, you know. Hmm. But I will play that right now on guitar, which is weird because it's really a piano song. But check it out. This is Burning Heart from Rocky IV. See if I can sing this early, guys. Two worlds collide, rival nations. It's a primitive clash, 20 years of frustration. Bravely we hope against all hope. It is so much at stake, seems our freedom's up against the ropes. Does the crowd understand? Is it East versus West, or man against man? Can any nation stand alone? In the burning heart, just about to burst, there's a quest for answers and unquenchable thirst. In the darkest night, rising like a spire, in the burning heart, the unmistakable fire. In the warrior's code, there's no surrender. Though his body says stop, his spirit cries never. Deep in our soul, a quiet ember knows it's you against you. It's the paradox that drives us on. It's a battle of wills in the heat of attack. It's the passion that kills. The victory is yours alone. In the burning heart, just about to burst, there's a quest for answers and unquenchable thirst. In the darkest night, rising like a spire, in the burning heart, the unmistakable fire. There you go.
Thank you.
Very awesome.
Did it, was it? I cracked the note. I really apologize for that.
The audience doesn't notice those things, Jim.
Okay, good, good.
You're too
fix
busy
it
rock.
In the mix. Okay,
that's right. Fix it in the mix.
Fix it in the mix.
Anywho. Now, speaking of your audience, you know, for guys like Matt and myself, your songs, whether we realize it at the time or not, were a large part of the soundtrack to our childhood. You know, between Survivor and all the hits that you wrote for 38 Special and other bands, you've written a lot of stuff. And
yeah.
I wanted to talk to you about your writing process now, you know, how that's changed over the years, and I guess how you access the muse these days, and how you keep the process interesting for yourself.
Wow, super great question. Actually, my process is exactly the same as it's always been, which is to say I never work when I try to work. In other words, I don't sit down at a piano usually and say, okay, I'm going to write a song. Usually I'm just, you know, it's a great job because I can be doing anything from shopping to mowing the lawn, and I'll get these ideas and little melody ideas. I remember I wrote The Search Is Over in riding in the car almost entirely in my head, with my realistic tape recorder next to me and my notebook. I can't tell you how many speeding tickets I talked myself out of, saying, you know, I don't know if it'll make a difference, but, you know, do you ever hear the song Eye of the Tiger? And the guy would go, well, yeah. Well, I'm the guy that wrote it, you know, and he'll write me out a warning ticket, you know, and say, well, slow down, you know. But the point is, I write when I'm doing everything else, you know, and of course, eventually you have to get to the piano or the guitar and find the chords that you've been hearing in your head. I'm always journalizing. What's that's a bad word. I'm always documenting the ideas I have. Like, I'll be talking to you, Jeff, or you, Matt, and you'll say something that you don't even know how cool it is, and I'll just jot it down. And of course, I won't give you credit, but you know, you're just always looking for hooks. You know, I always scan the possibilities of every situation I run into, every headline. Again, the term Search Is Over started as a a headline in a newspaper. Actually, it was a news broadcast where the announcer said, the search is over for the missing whatever. You know, and I said, the search is over. That's pretty cool. So really, the process is still the same. It's you know, 50% inspiration and 50% perspiration. It's, you know, nailing together all the ideas into a coherent form. And you need that seed of inspiration or a cause sometimes to bring the best out of you. You know, with 38 Special, the first thing we ever wrote together was Hold On Loosely. And, you know, it was such a great collaboration. We didn't even know each other at the time. And we sat down at my kitchen counter at my old house and looking at each other awkwardly. And finally, Jeff Carlisi broke the ice and said, well, you know, I got a guitar riff. And I said, well, let's hear it. And, you know, he sang, tick, 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 bam, bam. And he plays this incredible lick. I said, that'll work, you know. And then Don Barnes says, well, I got a title. And I said, well, what is it? And he's real shy. He says, well, Hold On Loosely. I go, what? He says, Hold On Loosely. I said, oh, man, but don't let go. And suddenly, you know, I love it when a song can be, can spring from real life. And suddenly I went back to my dating days with Karen, who, by the way, I've been married to now for almost 41 years. But when we were dating, I wasn't giving her enough oxygen to breathe. I think I was going a little too fast and not giving her the space she needed. And she would say, you know, Jim, back off. You know, you're too much. And finally, of course, we worked things out. But it informed that whole song. Because I had the lyric written, basically, you know, from my life. Hold on loosely, but don't let go. If you hold too tightly, you can lose control. So when real life becomes a song, those ideas really endure.
You know, I've got a question based around that, and that is, you know, with all these amazing collaborations, did you ever get any flack from Scotti Brothers, you know, them going, stop giving these songs away?
No, you know, I never did. I did get flack from Frankie Sullivan, though, you know, the guitar player Survivor. And, of course, he kind of lined up the troops against me with Mark, the drummer, too. You know, my argument is that there's room at the top of the charts for a lot of bands. And these songs, like Hold On Loosely, Caught Up in You, Fantasy Girl, I could have never written them with anybody but Don Barnes and Jeff Carlisi. It's a synergy. I couldn't, you know, those songs wouldn't exist, and then the world would be without those songs. So, you know, it was a little uncomfortable, especially when we, before Eye of the Tiger, when we weren't on the charts, and they were. But ultimately, you know, I was vindicated.
I think I could say the same thing, you know, about a song like Heavy Metal. You know, I don't think that song could really be a song for anybody else but, you know, Sammy Hagar.
Yeah, quite right. Quite right. And if you let me do another song, that's the other song I wanted to do. Is that a time to do that or no?
Love to.
You know what? I think there's no time like the present, sir.
That's my theory. Okay, hold on a second. So I'm going to set it up just really quickly. So my patron saint in this business, my mentor, if you will, was a guy named John Kolodner. He's the guy that appeared in a wedding, yeah, dressed in a long beard in Aerosmith's Pump video. He signed Survivor. He signed Aerosmith, signed Peter Gabriel, on and on. He's just a foreigner, amazing, very weird, eccentric, but a great guy. And he called me up and said, hi, this is John, and I want you to write with Sammy Hagar. And this is before Sammy Hagar was really a star in his own right. You know, he was Montrose singer and this and that. But, of course, I always loved his voice. I said, fantastic. So they flew me out to San Francisco. Sammy himself picks me up in his red Ferrari Daytona convertible. And, I mean, he was such a star, man. You know, driving down Mill Valley and everybody waving, Sammy, Sammy. You know, it's just what a vibe, you know. Takes me up to his place in Mill Valley, overlooking acres of redwood trees. It was just absolutely stunning. And he told me, we sat down in his Porta studio, and he had this little 8-track thing, you know, very unsophisticated in today's world of Pro Tools, but it was good enough. And he said, well, you know, my manager, Eddie Leffler, said, there's a animation called Heavy Metal coming out, and, you know, if we write something, it could be the title cut. And I said, okay, now we've got a target, you know. And I said, only one problem. We're really not heavy metal artists. And he said, yeah, I know what you mean. I said, but I guess it doesn't really matter. I said, let's do this. Let's write the song from the perspective of someone in the audience before a concert, before a heavy metal show. And I don't know about you guys, but for me, the most exciting part of a concert is the anticipation. It's sitting in the audience waiting for that great music. The lights going down and bam, the lights hit and there's the band, you know. So we tried to harness that vibe and we wrote this song in about, 45 minutes and demoed it. And it made the title cut of the movie. So I'm going to play it right now. And for you guitar aficionados, this is a drop D tuning where the low E goes to the D and makes it sound massive. Hold on a second here. I'm going to retune.
Nice.
All righty. Headbangers in leather, sparks flying in the dead of the night. It all comes together when they shoot out the lights. 50,000 watts of power, and it's pushing overload. The beast is ready to devour all the metal it can hold. About to explode, about to overload. It's your one way to get to midnight. Call it heavy metal, high and high, feeling just right. Call it heavy metal, desperation on the red line. Call it heavy metal noise. Come on. Top pants and lipstick, she's flying on the razor's edge. She holds her own against the boys, cuts through the crowd just like a witch. Ooh, can't you feel the static? So many contacts are being made. We got up front fanatics breaking down the barricades to reach the stage. Can't you feel the rage? It's your one way to get to midnight. Call it heavy metal, high and high, feeling just right. Call it heavy metal, desperation on the red line. Call it heavy metal, high and high, feeling just right. Call it heavy metal noise. Heavy metal noise. Heavy metal noise. Call it heavy metal. Something like that.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
That was...
I think we have to ask, with that being in drop D, can we should we give credit to Jim Peterick for inventing grunge?
I take no credit or blame for that. No, usually the grunge guys, they tune everything down, not just the E string. I mean, they're down in the basement, man.
All right. Well, hey, I always found that the Survivor songwriting had an interesting complexity to it that I don't think you guys got enough credit for. You know, listening to those songs now, it's interesting to hear how they were structured in stages and at points almost very Broadway-like in the pacing. What were the influential drivers for you as a songwriter that really influenced your approach to how you put songs together?
Well, I grew up, of course, I had older sisters. My first love was Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash. That's not really reflected in my music that much, but that was the basis of it. But before the Beatles came along, it was really, I was drawn to the songs of Burt Bacharach and Hal David, Jerry Goff and Carole King, Cynthia Weil, Barry Mann. I didn't know who was writing the songs, but every time I would love a song, it turned out to be one of those teams. And I think my, you know, when you say Broadway and sophistication or complexity, I think it's that's what did it. You know, Burt Bacharach was such a great instrumentalist, and Hal David, they don't get much better as a lyricist. Things like Alfie and What the World Needs Now, I was very much influenced by that. And then specifically, like the Broadway thing, it's funny you should say that because no one's ever said that. I remember I went to see Cats with my wife the first time it came around, 1984, something like that. And I was just about to write a power ballad. I felt it coming. And after Cats, I wrote Man Against the World. And I think that, you know, that's probably one of the most Broadway songs we have. You can picture it on stage. I Give You a Man Against the World. I mean, that was directly influenced by Cats. So, yeah, I'm not your normal rocker in that. My roots go back more to the songwriting teams than to the Rolling Stones. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I also always heard, and it's, I mean, Man Against the World certainly was one of those songs I was thinking of, but there are also important musical elements that I always heard driving those moments of transition. I mean, one obvious one that I comes to mind is the way your piano kicks off the start of that first verse on Eye of the Tiger after that long buildup.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the longest intro in any modern rock hit, 30 seconds of intro. That goes against all reason, you know, and yet it's the most powerful part of the song. I wrote it on piano, which is pretty obvious. I mean, it's really an R&B song. If you really break it down, those minor key changes, that's R&B. But, you know, with Frankie's guitar and Dave's voice, it became rock.
And, you know, that's what I was going to say. With the songs that you were writing, what sort of pushback did you get from the labels as far as, well, we're going to have to lose all that with a radio edit to get it on the radio? Did you get much pressure?
I got to say, the Scotties were great. They gave us our head. The first album was produced by Ron Nevison, who is just fantastic. He, of course, did Dave Mason and engineered Led Zeppelin and Bad Company. He went on to do Starship and Heart. And we were right in the middle of that in 1979, and we were lucky enough to work with him. Second album came along, and Johnny Musso with Scotty Brothers said, you know, Frankie and Jim, your demos sound so good. Why don't you guys produce it? This is unheard of for the Lunatics to be running the asylum. I mean, but we did great. And that carried through to the Eye of the Tiger record, where me and Frankie produced that as well. They didn't meddle hardly at all. Well, first of all, we had very good commercial instincts. We knew our singles had to be, you know, 3 minutes. They had nothing to complain about, but we were very blessed in that they trusted us.
When you got Jameson into the band, it seems like that would, from a songwriter standpoint, get you excited as far as like new directions and new places that you could take the material.
Boy, you could say that again. I write different for every singer. I think a lot of writers do. And when I was writing for Dave Bickler and his voice and character, it was very tough, very street. Things like Poor Man's Son, Eye of the Tiger, Love Is on My Side, you know, on and on. And it fit his voice. When we auditioned Jimmy, we probably auditioned 5 singers that week. And one of the contenders was Kevin Chalfant of 707 in The Storm. And we almost said yes. And the next day, Jimmy came in and blew everybody's socks off. And when I heard that voice, I remember the first song I taught him was Broken Promises. And I heard his sound in my ear, and I had goosebumps. It was such a magical sound. And he has that, what I call the yodel, the Blue Mountain yodel in his voice. He's got just a little of that country twang, just enough to be distinctive. And I heard that voice, and I knew that my writing was going to change, and it was going to get more melodic, more pop, a little more romantic, and a little more of a equal male-female demographic.
Well, I think he definitely has, you know, you guys had a lucky strike because he ended up having one of the most distinctive voices of the 80s. I mean, he was definitely a guy that you knew a Survivor song, you know, with him singing.
Exactly. And how rare is it to be able to switch singers and survive, no pun intended. You know, they were enough similar that it wasn't a major head transplant. You know, they were very distinctive, and yet it wasn't a shock to the fan base.
I want to move into some other stuff here. First of all, you know, I love the fact that you're one of these guys, and it doesn't surprise me at all, that has a huge guitar collection. You know, 170 plus guitars. Can you justify your ownership of each and every one of those?
Well, if you ask my wife, no, no. She's a peach because she lets me keep them. I said, Karen, as long as I'm not doing drugs and chasing women, this is pretty cool, right? And, you know, she can't argue with that. I have them all over my house, and now it's up to 180, Matt and Jeff. I've been a bad boy this Christmas. And, I gifted myself a wonderful five-string Ibanez bass that has this huge cutaway. It's the biggest bout I've ever seen. I used it for the first time in the studio yesterday, and the thing shook the earth. But I'm always finding a guitar that I can't live without, you know. And there is a story behind every one. And I never sell guitars. I just keep buying them. Some of my guitars are worth, you know, many, many thousands of dollars. I have one of the original Flying Vs that's worth about $250,000. 1960 Black Beauty Les Paul that's in mint condition is worth at least $100,000. But then I also have just fun guitars. You know, I started getting into the Monarix, which has that incredible flame carving at the back end. And I've had them painted by a girl named Kat Clausen, who's a fine artist in Chicago. So I just keep things interesting. And when I go on stage with the Ides of March or World Stage, you never know what I'm going to show up with. And it's always fun.
Yeah, I actually just saw you play one of those on internet video of your appearance from this week with the Ides on WGN. It was cool to see that guitar.
Yeah, yeah, that's my... now, that one is not painted. The finish was so pretty. I left it being the flame sunburst with a quilted maple top. I'm not going to cover that one up. But they're actually, you know, they look like they would weigh a ton, but they're chambered and they're really quite light.
You've got your guitars, you've got your cars. Clearly, you're doing something right, and you're in a position where, you know, you can pursue projects because you want to, and not go after the quick and easy buck because you have to. And that puts you in a kind of a rarefied position among a lot of your peers. I wonder, do you get a lot of guys coming to you asking for advice on how to manage their funds or their careers so they can walk in your footsteps?
Well, you know, I'm not the best one to give advice on that. I would rather give them musical advice. I have that coming to me all the time where I actually have to cut off the amount of demos I get and only take them from, you know, friends of friends because it would be outrageous. But every so often a tape comes along or a disc, you know, that it makes me stop and listen, you know. And Larry Millis, he's my musical partner. I've known him since third grade. He runs my studio, which is World Stage International. And I heard a voice coming from the other room a few months ago, and this incredible rock tenor voice. I came in, and it's a guy named Mark Scherer, S-C-H-E-R-E-R. And he is in a band called Ark of Ages. But I was interested in him doing the demos for Pride of Lions. So with Serafino, he needs to okay every song. And I accept that because he's kind of like my new Kolodner. I love someone that knows what they're doing, that only expects the best out of me, that brings the best out of me. I love pressure. And I love someone who's waiting for the best. And that's been Serafino throughout the years with Pride of Lions. Maestro, you can do better. I've heard you do better. This is not good. You know, and sometimes I'll be in denial about that until I realize, you know, he's right. So this time, instead of sending him the album and him rejecting half of it, I sent him song by song. And I only had three songs rejected this time for the Immortal record. But I had Mark Shearer sing all the demos because Toby lives in Evansville. And, you know, I loved working with his voice so much that I'm doing an album with him right now. Mark Shearer, and it's called Voice of the Heart. And the title cut is Voices of the Heart, which was out on Frontiers by a singer that just escaped my name Philip Bardowell. He did such a heck of a job on Voices of the Heart, and I all of a sudden heard Mark singing it. It's going to be the title cut for the album. So, you know, and then Lisa McLowry, you know, she's this multi-octave. First of all, she's gorgeous to look at, and she's gorgeous. She's a gorgeous person and a great, great, great singer. So, you know, I've been producing her albums, one called Time Signatures that was out 3 years ago, and the latest one is Acoustic Alchemy. Lisa McLowry sings Acoustic Alchemy, where I put the lyrics to my favorite smooth jazz slash new age band, Acoustic Alchemy, out of Britain. And that's the album that's out now. So, and it's doing very well. There's a song called Brand New Hallelujah that's starting to take off at gospel radio.
I was really interested to see you, you know, move into the Life Force project that you've done in the past couple of years. What pushed you in that direction?
Well, you know, when I got home from the road, you know, any time, whether we were on the road with Brian Adams or REO or Triumph, you know, and I got back to my home life, the last thing I wanted to do was listen to more rock music. I needed an escape from that, and Karen and I found it in smooth jazz. They didn't call it smooth jazz then because that's just a name. But it was groups, we fell in love with groups like Spyro Gyra, Dave Grusin, the Yellow Jackets, on and on, Fatburger, of course, Ahmad Jamal, and, you know, on and on. And whenever I was doodling around on the piano, I would be playing these really pretty instrumentals. And, you know, Karen one day said, you know, why don't you get into that and do an album like that? It doesn't have to be your whole career, you know, just a project. And I thought about it and I said, that's a great idea. And that spawned the first Life Force record, which came out a few years ago in 2007 or 8, which is simply called Life Force. And that cover, by the way, is also painted by Kat Clawson. That's my guitar art girl. Did very well.
Cool.
And it combined some of the brand new ones with like a jazz outing of Vehicle, Eye of the Tiger, and Searches Over was a duet with Lisa McLowry. Very reimagined. And then just last year, I put out Forces at Play, which again, you know, found its home on many jazz stations. So it's been a good ride.
And you mentioned being in the studio. What have you been working on in the studio?
The things at play right now, and Mark Shearer, we're about three quarters done with an album. We're doing backgrounds today with a very talented girl named Shoshana Bean, who made a name for herself on Broadway and as a solo artist. We're lucky to have her sing. I've got a kids band, siblings, 11-year-old boy named Eli, two twins at age 13. They're called Ariel, Zoe, and Eli 2. And recorded a track with them called Hey Bully, because they're really into the anti-bullying campaign. And they did a video, and it you know, we're sitting at almost a million hits. And then the father of the kids, who was, you know, really behind it, said, let's do more songs. And so I wrote four more that are just very kitschy Disney mentality, but with quality. You know, I mean, I'm not going to put out, you know, something that I can't stand behind. But there's a really cute song called Acre on the Moon, and another one called Bring It, and another one called High School Yearbook. But I get to flex that muscle of being, you know, a young teenager again, and I can still do that.
That's very cool. Well, why don't we, if we can have you do another song, I'll let you even pick this one. I would say I'm going back and forth between, you know, either the obvious Search or Vehicle.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with the latter, because the Search is such a piano song that I would be afraid to do it. I wanted to add one more thing, another gratuitous plug for my son. His name is Colin.
Sure.
He's 23 years old and absolutely a brilliant singer-songwriter, keyboard player. His album called CJ, which is his stage name, S-I-J-A-Y, his album's called Detroit Club, and it just hit iTunes, and we're doing a video, and I'm so proud of him. And I didn't have anything to do with any of the songwriting. It's all his head. Larry engineered most of it. Bruce Swedeen of Michael Jackson
wow.
fame engineered two songs. We went up to his ranch in Florida, and what a great experience to work with one of the masters. So I wanted to put that plug in for CJ. But I'm gonna do that song that came out in 1970. I was 19. The Ides of March were playing, you know, teen clubs in the area. Suddenly we had a number one record. And the summer of 1970, we were on the road with groups like Led Zeppelin, Janis Joplin, the Grateful Dead, Poco, just so many. I mean, what a great year to have a number one record and rub elbows with all these great iconic rock bands. So I'm going to introduce this the way I have ever since 1970. I'm going to go like this. Okay, everybody, this is the last song tonight. Strap yourself in. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And this is the vehicle that got me here today. One, two. Ba-da-ba-ba-da. Oh, I got to get rid of that low D. Ah! Can't do vehicle with low D. This is rock and roll radio. This is reality radio. Ain't no overdubs here, baby. Okay, one, two. Ba-da-ba-ba-da. Ba-da-ba-ba-dum. Hey, well, I'm the friendly stranger in the black sedan. Won't you hop inside my car? I got pictures, got candy, I'm a lovable man. Take it to the nearest stop. I'm your vehicle, baby. Take it anywhere you want to go. I'm your vehicle, woman. And now I'm sure you know that I love you. I need you. Won't you got to have your child? Great God in heaven, you know I love you. Well, if you want to be a movie star, I'll take you to Hollywood. But if you want to stay just like you are, you know I think you really should. I'm your vehicle, baby. Take you anywhere you want to go. I'm your vehicle, woman. By now I'm sure you know that I love you, I need you. Won't you got to have your child? Great God in heaven, you know I love you. Ba-da-ba-ba-da. And I'm your vehicle, baby. Ba-la-la-la-la-la-ba-ba-da. Oh, don't you know that I love you, I need you. I want you got to have your child. Great God in heaven, you know I love you. One, two, ba-da-ba-ba-da. Alrighty then.
I could almost imagine you sitting around the house playing that and Karen saying, I know that brought us a lot of money, but please, not again.
You know what? I love it. I always say to my audience, or our audience, as long as you're out there clapping along, singing along with the horn parts and enjoying it, I feel like I'm 19 years old again.
That's awesome.
That's perfect.
Well, I want to wrap up with just one final question here, and then we'll wrap this up. I just wanted to ask, you mentioned it earlier, the record that you did with Jimmy, Crossroads Moment, was, you know, so well received. Is there a possibility of another record with him?
Well, there is. There always is. The last one, they used another producer and did a very nice job. But we talk all the time, and there's a certain thing that we have together that no other combination can have. We really know how to mine that part of Survivor, and I love working with him. He's a great person, great guy, and that possibility always exists.
Cool. Well, yeah, I actually talked to him a few weeks ago, and you know, he said he was into it, and he's like, that just, of course, would be a question for Jim. So I wanted to be fair and put it to you as well. So,
well, now I know it's going to happen.
There we go. Well, hey, thank you so much for the time today. Is there anything else, you know, that we didn't cover, you know, Pride of Lions or whatever, that you want to cover off on before we wrap?
You know, we did pretty good. We really did. I did want to mention, though, that I'm almost finished with my autobiography, which will be coming out mid-year, 2013. It's called Through the Eye of the Tiger, A Survivor's Tale. And it's been just a great, great process for me to go back and recount the days ever since I was, you know, 2 years old, sitting on the stoop of my Southwest Wesley home in Berwyn, Illinois, And then 4 years old, watching the cars go by and naming everyone with my buddies, Binky and Johnny, all the way through the Ides of March, putting them together and putting together Survivor, all the bands I worked with, A Thousand Stories, and a lot of tears, you know, and a lot of laughs. It's been a really great process.
I'm looking forward to reading it.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm anticipating that one as well. Who'd you end up writing that with? Did you write that with anybody?
You know, I have two editors, you know, I wrote it all myself. And Lisa Torum, a really nice journalist who writes for Penny Black Music, the internet site from the UK. She kept me honest and, you know, made sure all my punctuation was right and didn't ramble on. But it's basically my voice.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for the time. This was a real pleasure.
Oh, thanks, Matt and Jeff. Really a pleasure. And I mean that. You guys are doing great work. Please keep the flame burning.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
We'll do it, man.
All right.
Well, thank you again.
I'll talk to you soon, guys.